To avoid having to remove their shackles, Mansier, the jailer, bundled Hal, who was still chained to his father, into the solitary cell near the top of the spiral staircase, while the rest went below. Hal and Sir Francis sat side by side on the stone shelf that served as a bed. As soon as they were alone, Hal blurted out, "Father, I want to explain to you about Katinka. I mean, about the governor's wife." Sir Francis embraced him awkwardly, hampered by the chains. "Unlikely as it now seems, I was young once. You do not have to speak about that harlot again. She is not worthy of your consideration." "I will never love another woman, not as long as I live," Hal said bitterly. "What you felt for that woman was not love, my son." Sir Francis shook his head. "Your love is a precious currency. Spend it only in the market, where you will not be cheated again." At that, there was a tapping on the iron bars of the next cell, and Althuda called, "How goes the trial, Captain Courtney? Have they given you a good taste of company justice?" Sir Francis raised his voice to answer. "It goes as you said it would, Althuda. It is obvious that you have also experienced it. The governor is the only god in this little heaven called Good Hope. Here justice is that which pays a profit to the Dutch East India Company, or a bribe to its servants. Has the judge pronounced you guilty yet?" "No, not yet. Van der Velde has gone to guzzle at his trough." "You must pray that he values labour for his walls more than revenge. That way you might still slip through Slow John's fingers. Is there anything you are hiding from him? Anything they want from you? To betray a comrade, perhaps?" Althuda asked. "If there is not, then you might still escape the little room under the armoury where Slow John does his work." "We are hiding nothing," Sir Francis said. "Are we, Hal?"
"Nothing," Hal agreed loyally.
"But," Sir Francis went on, "Van der Velde believes that we are." "Then all I can say, my friend, is may Almighty Allah have pity on you." Those last hours together went too swiftly for Hal. He and his father spent the time talking softly together. Every so often Sir Francis broke off in a fit of coughing. His eyes glittered feverishly in the dim light, and when Hal touched his skin it was hot and clammy. Sir Francis spoke of High Weald like a man who knows he will never see his home again. When he described the river and the hill, Hal dimly remembered them, and the salmon coming upstream in the spring, and the stags roaring in the rut. When he spoke of his wife, Hal tried to recall his mother's face, but saw only the woman in the miniature painting he had left buried at the Elephant Lagoon, and not the real live person. "These last years she has faded in my own memory," Sir Francis admitted. "But now her face comes back to me vividly, as young and fresh and sweet as she ever was. I wonder, is it because soon we will be together again? Is she waiting for me?"
"I know she is, Father."
Hal gave him the reassurance he needed. "But I need you most, and I know that we will be together many more years before you go to my mother." Sir Francis smiled regretfully and looked up at the tiny window set high on the stone wall.
"Last night I climbed up and looked through the bars, and the red comet was still in the sign of Virgo. It seemed closer and fiercer, for its fiery tail had altogether obliterated my star."
They heard the tramp of the guards approaching, and the clash of keys in the iron door. Sir Francis turned to Hal.
"For the last time, let me kiss you, my son."
His father's lips were dry and hot with the fever in his blood. The contact was brief. Then the door to the cell was thrown open.
"Don't keep the governor and Slow John waiting now," said Sergeant Mansier jovially. "Out with the pair of you."
The atmosphere among the spectators in the courtroom was like that at the cockpit just before the spurred birds are released to tear into each other in a cloud of flying feathers. Sir Francis and Hal led in the long file of prisoners, and before he could prevent himself, Hal looked quickly towards the railed-off area at the far end of the hall. Katinka sat in her place in the centre of the front row, with Zelda directly behind her. The maid leered viciously at Hal, But there was a soft, contented smile on Katinka's face, and her eyes sparkled with violet lights that seemed to light the dim recesses of the room. Hal looked away quickly, startled by the sudden hot hatred that had replaced the adoration he had so recently felt for her. How could it have happened so quickly, he wondered, and knew that if he had a sword in his hand, he would not hesitate to drive the point between the peaks of her soft white breasts. As he sank into his seat, he felt compelled to look up again into the pack of spectators. This time he went cold, as he saw another pair of eyes, pale and watchful as those of a leopard, fastened on his father's face. Slow John sat in the front row of the gallery. He looked like a preacher in his puritanical black suit, the wide-brimmed hat set squarely upon his head. "Do not look at him," Sir Francis said softly, and Hal realized that his father, too, was intensely aware of the scrutiny of those strange faded eyes. As soon as the hall had settled into an expectant silence, Van der Velde appeared through the door of the audience chamber beyond. When he lowered himself into his seat, his smile was expansive, and his wig was just the slightest bit awry. He belched softly, for clearly he had eaten well. Then he looked down on the prisoners, with such a benign expression that Hal felt an unwarranted surge of hope for the outcome. "I have considered the evidence that has been laid before this court," the governor began, without preamble, "and I want to say right at the outset that I was impressed with the manner in which both the advocates presented their cases. Colonel Schroeder was a paradigm of succinctness." He stumbled over both of the longer words, then belched again. Hal fancied that he detected a whiff of cumin and garlic on the warm air that reached him a few seconds later. Next, Van der Velde turned a paternal eye on Jacobus Hopp. "The advocate for the defence behaved admirably and made a good job of a hopeless case, and I shall make a note to that effect in his company file." Hopp bobbed his head and coloured with gratification. However, he now looked squarely at the benches of the prisoners. "While considering the evidence, I've given much thought to the defence raised by Mynheer Hopp, namely that the pirates were operating under a letter of marque issued by the King of England, and that when they attacked the company galleon, Die Starnfastigheid, they were unaware of the cessation of hostilities between the belligerents in the recent war. I have been forced by irrefutable evidence to the contrary to reject this line of defence in its entirety. Accordingly, I find all 24 of the accused persons guilty of piracy on the high seas, of robbery and abduction and murder." The seamen on the benches stared at him in pale silence. "Is there anything you wish to say before I pass sentence upon you?" Van der Velde asked, and opened his silver snuff-box. Sir Francis spoke out in a voice that rang the length and breadth of the hall. "We are prisoners of war. You do not have the right to chain us like slaves. Neither do you have the right to try us, nor to pass sentence upon us." Van der Velde took a pinch of snuff up each nostril and then sneezed deliciously, spraying the court writer who sat beside him. The clerk closed the one eye nearest to the governor, but kept his quill flying across the page in an effort to keep up with the proceedings. "I believe that you and I have discussed this opinion before," Van der Velde nodded mockingly towards Sir Francis. "I will now proceed to sentence these pirates. I will deal firstly with the four negroes. Let the following persons stand forth. Abeli, Matizi, Ijiri, Ikimati." The four were shackled in pairs, and now the guards prodded them to their feet. They shuffled forward and stood below the dais. Van der Velde regarded them sternly. "I have taken into account that you are ignorant savages, and therefore cannot be expected to behave like decent Christians. Although your crimes reek to heaven and cry for retribution, I am inclined to mercy. I condemn you to lifelong slavery. You will be sold by the auctioneer of the Dutch East India Company to the highest bidder at auction, and the monies received from this sale will be paid into the company treasury. Take them away, Sergeant." As they were led from the hall, Abberley looked across at Sir Francis and Hal. His dark face was impassive behind the mask of tattoos, but his eyes sent them the message of his heart. "Next I will deal with the pirates," Van der Velde announced. "Let the following prisoners stand forth." He read from the list in his hand. "Henry Courtney, officer and mate. Ned Tyler, boatswain. Daniel Fisher, boatswain. William Rogers, seaman." He read out every name except that of Sir Francis Courtenay. When Sir Francis rose beside his son, Van der Velde stopped him.
Not you. You're the captain and the instigator of this gang of rogues. I have other plans for you. Have the armourer separate him from the other prisoner.
The man hurried forward from the back of the court with the leather satchel containing his tools and worked swiftly to knock the shackle out of the links that bound Hal to his father. Sir Francis sat alone on the long bench as Hal left him and went forward to take his place at the head of the row of prisoners below the dais. Van der Velde studied their faces, beginning at one end of the line and moving his brooding gaze slowly along until he arrived at Hal.
A more murderous bunch of cutthroats I have never laid eyes upon. No honest man or woman is safe when creatures like you are at large. You are fit only for the gibbet.
As he stared at Hal, a sudden thought occurred to him, and he glanced away towards the buzzard who sat beside the lovely Katinka at the side of the hall.
"My lord," he called, "may I trouble you for a word in private?"
Leaving the prisoners standing, Van der Velde heaved his bulk onto his feet and waddled back through the doors in the audience chamber behind him. The buzzard made an elaborate bow to Katinka and followed the governor. As he entered the chamber, he found Van der Velde selecting a morsel from the silver tray on the polished yellowwood table. He turned to the buzzard, his mouth already filled.
A sudden thought occurred to me. If I am to send Francis Courtenay to the executioner for questioning as to the whereabouts of the missing cargo, should not his son go also? Surely Courtenay would have told his son, or had him with him, when he secreted the treasure. What do you think, my lord?
The buzzard looked grave and tugged at his beard as he pretended to consider the question. He had wondered how long it would take this great hog to come round to this way of thinking, and he had long ago prepared his answer. He knew he could rely on the fact that Sir Francis Courtenay would never reveal the whereabouts of his wealth, not even to the most cunning and persistent tormentor. He was just too stubborn and pig-headed, unless, and here was the one possible case in which he might capitulate, if he were to save his only son.
Your Excellency, I think you need have no fear that any living person knows where the treasure is apart from the pirate himself. He is much too avaricious and suspicious to trust another human being.
Van der Velde looked dubious and helped himself to another curried samosa from the tray. While he munched, the buzzard mulled over his best line of argument. Should Van der Velde choose to debate it further? There was no question in the buzzard's mind but that Hal Courtenay knew where the treasure from the Standfastigheid lay. What was more, he almost certainly knew where the other hoard from the Helekernacht was hidden. Unlike his father, the youngster would be unable to withstand the questioning by Slow John, and even if he proved tougher than the buzzard believed, his father would certainly break down when he saw his son on the rack. One way or the other, the two would lead the Dutch to the hoard, and that was the last thing on earth that the buzzard wanted to happen. His grave expression almost cracked into a grin as he realized the irony of his being forced to save Henry Courtenay from the attentions of Slow John. But if he wanted the treasure for himself, he must make sure that neither father nor son led the cheeseheads to it first. The best place for Sir Francis was the gallows, and the best place for his brat was the dungeon under the castle walls. This time he could not prevent the grin reaching his lips as he thought that while Slow John was still cooling his branding irons in Sir Francis's blood, the gull would be flying back to Elephant Lagoon to winkle out those sacks of guilders and those bars of gold from whatever nook or cranny Sir Francis had tucked them into. He turned the grin now on Van der Velde.
Now, Your Excellency, I give you my assurance that Francis Courtenay is the only man alive who knows where it is. He may look hard and talk bravely, but Frankie will roll over and spread his thighs like a whore offered a gold guinea just as soon as Slow John gets to work on him. My advice is that you send Henry Courtenay to work on the castle and rely on his father to lead you to the booty.
Yeah, Van der Velde nodded. That's what I thought myself. I just wanted you to confirm what I already knew.
He popped one last samosa into his mouth and spoke around it.
Let's go back and get the business finished, then.
The prisoners were still waiting in their chains below the dais, like oxen in the traces, as Van der Velde settled himself into his chair again.
The gibbet and the gallows, these are your natural homes, but they are too good for you. I sentence every last man of you to a lifetime of labor in the service of the Dutch East India Company, which you conspired to cheat and rob, and whose servants you abducted and maltreated. Do not think this is kindness on my part or weakness. There will come a time when you will weep to the Almighty and beg him for the easy death that I denied you this day. Take them away and put them to work immediately. The sight of them offends my eyes and those of all honest men.
As they were herded from the hall, Katinka hissed with frustration and made a gesture of annoyance. Cambry leaned closer to her and asked, "What is it that troubles you, madam?"
"I fear my husband has made a mistake. He should have sent them to the pyre on the parade."
Now she would be denied the thrill of watching slow John work on the beautiful brat and listening to his screams. It would have been a deeply satisfying conclusion to the affair. Her husband had promised it to her, and he had cheated her of the pleasure. She would make him suffer for that, she decided.
"Ah, madam, revenge is best savoured like a pipe of good Virginia tobacco, not gobbled up in a rush. Any time in the future that the fancy takes you, you need only look up the castle walls. There they will be, being worked slowly to death."
Hal passed close by where Sir Francis sat on the long bench. His father looked forlorn and sick, with his hair and beard in lank ropes and black shadows beneath his eyes, in dreadful contrast with his pale skin. Hal could not bear it, and suddenly he cried, "Father!" and would have run to him, but Sergeant Mansier had anticipated him and stepped in front of him with the long cane in his right hand. Hal backed away. His father did not look up, and Hal realized that he had taken his farewell and had moved on into the far territory, where only Slow John would be able now to reach him. When the file of convicts had left the hall and the doors had closed behind them, a hush fell and every eye rested on the lonely figure on the bench. "Francis Courtney," Van der Velde said loudly, "stand forth." Sir Francis threw back his head, flicking the greying hair out of his eyes. He shrugged off the guard's hands and rose unaided to his feet. He held his head high as he marched to the dais, and his torn shirt flapped around his naked back. The cane stripes had begun to dry into crusted black scabs. "Francis Courtney, it is not by chance, I am certain, that you bear the same Christian name as that most notorious of all pirates, the rogue Francis Drake."
"I have the honour to be named for the famous seafarer," said Sir Francis softly.
"Then I have the even greater honour of passing sentence upon you. I sentence you to death."
Van der Velde waited for Sir Francis to show some emotion, but he stared back without expression. At last the governor was forced to continue.
"I repeat, your sentence is death, but the manner of your death will be of your own choosing."
Abruptly and unexpectedly, he let out a mellow guffaw.
"There are not many rogues of your calibre that are treated with such beneficence and condescension."
"With your permission, I shall withhold any expression of gratitude until I hear the rest of your proposal," Sir Francis murmured, and Van der Velde stopped laughing.
"Not all the cargo from the Standfast Hate has been recovered. By far the most valuable portion is still missing, and there is no doubt in my mind that you were able to secrete this before you were captured by the troops of the Honourable Company. Are you prepared to reveal the hiding place of the missing cargo to the officers of the company? In that case, your execution will be a swift and clean beheading."
"I have nothing to tell you," said Sir Francis in a disinterested tone.
"Then I fear you will be asked the same question under extreme compulsion by the state executioner."
Van der Velde smacked his lips softly as though the words tasted good on his tongue.
"Should you answer fully and without reservation, the headsman's axe will put an end to your suffering. Should you remain obstinate, the questioning will continue. At all times, the choice will remain yours."
"Your Excellency is a paragon of mercy," Sir Francis bowed. "But I cannot answer the question, for I know nothing of the cargo of which you speak."
"Then, Almighty God, have mercy on your soul," said Van der Velde.
and turned to Sergeant Mancier. "Take the prisoner away and place him in the charge of the state executioner." Hal balanced high on the scaffolding on the unfinished wall of the eastern bastion of the castle. This was only the second day of the labours that were to last the rest of his natural life, and already the palms of his hands and both his shoulders were rubbed raw by the ropes and the rough, undressed stone blocks. One of his fingertips was crushed, and the nail was the colour of purple grape. Each masonry block weighed a ton or more, and had to be manhandled up the rickety scaffolding of bamboo poles and planks. In the gang of convicts working with him were Big Daniel and Ned Tyler, neither of whom was fully recovered from his wounds. Their injuries were plain to see, for all were dressed only in petticoats of ragged canvas. The musket ball had left a deep, dark purple crater in Daniel's chest, and a lion's claw across his back where Hal had cut him. The scabs over these wounds had burst open with his exertions and were weeping watery, blood-tinged lymph. The sword wound crawled like a raw red vine around Ned's thigh, and he limped heavily as he moved along the scaffold. After their privations in the slave deck of the Gull, they were all honed clean of the last ounce of fat. They were lean as hunting dogs, and stringy muscle and bone stood out clearly beneath their sun-reddened skins. Though the sun still shone brightly, the winter wind whistled in from the northwest and seemed to abrade their bodies like ground glass. In unison they hauled at the tail of the heavy manila rope, and the sheaves screeched in their blocks as the great yellow lump of stone lifted from the truck of the wagon far below and began its perilous ascent up the high structure.